Good evening, everybody. My name is Tom Whalen. I'm an alcoholic. I, just my own pleasure, I guess. I just like to know if the people that have less than 30 days would raise their hands so I get some idea who I'm talking to. Thank you. That's great. There's really nothing worse than to give an AA talk with a bunch of in front of a bunch of old timers. Anyway, I came in the room tonight and I was greeted by a lot of old friends of mine. The reason I know they're old friends is because they're all old, unfortunately, like I am. Anyway, bring back a lot of memories and stuff like that from the early days. I thought they'd all died, but they just moved to Las Vegas, so I guess that's I'm sorry. Anyway, my wife Gloria and I have had a nice couple of days here singing the sights and stuff like that. We've had a nice visit. And I'm going to do what we're asked to do when we come to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and that's to tell a little bit about what I used to be like, what happened to me, and what I'm like now. And if you can get some good out of it, all the better. I know that I will, because I've been sober a long time. Don't get ahead of me. I don't want to spoil my talk. If I tell you, you'll leave the room. And sometimes you get, you know, things go bad or things go good or whatever it happens to be, and you've been to all those damn meetings and stuff like that, and you kind of forget what you used to be like, and all of a sudden maybe drinking doesn't look like such a bad idea anymore. And what it does for me, and this is mainly for the new people here, in the fact that we share back and forth our experience, strength, and hope, and in our drinking stories and our sobriety stories, is that we have a chance to not only help you, but the chance is that I remind myself of what I used to be like and what happened to me and what I'm like now. Of course, I didn't start drinking until I was in grammar school. I didn't want to get in too soon. I want to keep it back a little bit. And I love to drink. One of the problems that I have when I give my AA talk is that I talk about the fact that I really enjoy drinking. I like the way it tasted and where I drank it. I love being loaded. There's nothing better, really, when you think about it, than laying on your bed, stoned out of your mind, listening to some good jazz music and watching the ceiling roll around. It's just terrific. And you have all that wonderful control. If you can just drag your leg over to the side of the bed on the floor, everything stops and it's fine again, you know, and it's just terrific. And unfortunately, life interfered with my drinking. I would have been fine if I could have been just left alone to drink and be loaded and do what I wanted to do, but life didn't work out quite that way. I did the normal things in West Los Angeles, where I was born and raised. I went to St. Paul the Apostle Grammar School, and my kind of an odd upbringing in that my father was a hard-working electrical contractor in West Los Angeles and the area there. And my sister was a very well-known movie actress in the late 30s and 40s. And I was exposed to two different kinds of life and lifestyles and things like that. And her life was movie sound stages and Broadway plays where she appeared. I lived in New York for a couple of years where I went to school, and it was an exciting life. Back when I was going to school in the late 40s and early 50s, I used to go down to places like Bop City and Birdland and see people like Charlie Parker and Miles Davis when they were getting their start, and it was exciting. And Ryan Ginger was just easy to get. I was 14, 15 years old, but I looked a little older, and I could drink in those bars, and it was just, it was wonderful. I complained about being in New York and being away from Los Angeles, but I really loved the life in New York and all that stuff that went with it. And I begged and pleaded and got back to Los Angeles, and I finished my last 2 years of high school at a school called Loyola High School in Los Angeles, and there my only claim to fame is that I carried a bottle in my glove compartment and went to Latin class, smashed a few times, and got out of school, and I went down to Santa Monica City College, where I enrolled with a few classes to start my college career. And by this time I was 18, 19 years old. And if you could have seen me in those days, and you could have observed me and my behavior, I was a full-blown alcoholic, but I couldn't see any of that, and I'm sure I kept it hidden from everybody. When I came into zoology class once, the instructor at 8 o'clock in the morning, he stopped the class, and he pointed to me, and he said, "Behold, the ghost who walks," like I was some kind of strange person to watch coming lumbering around, loaded and hungover, or both. And I wanted to get out of school. I was dating this, I wanted to get out of Los Angeles, and I was dating this girl that I really didn't want to be involved with anymore, and so I volunteered to be drafted, and I went in the Army, and I went overseas immediately. I went to Arkansas, Oklahoma, and Kentucky, which is overseas if you're a native Californian. And I was down there about a year, and she decided to come down to visit me for the weekend. And she flew down to Fort Smith, got off the plane, and said, "Well, now that I'm here, why don't we get married?" And I thought, well, okay, big strong Tom. So we got married and signed a suicide pact for the next 20 years and rode off into the world of miserable destiny. And when I got out of the Army in 56, not only was I married to her, but I have these two babies now. I have one a year old and one getting born, and I was barely 22 years old. I felt like my life was over. I hadn't even dated, for Christ's sake. And here I am, shackled with these responsibilities. And so I went back to work for my father in the electrical contracting business, which I didn't particularly feel I had an aptitude for, and I didn't particularly like, but it was an easier, softer way. It was earn a living and whatever. And I've been raised very well. I have raised with very good values. I know how to behave and how to act and what's the right way to do things and the wrong way to do things and what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. And looking at my life and the little bit of inventory I was doing, drinking during the day, as I've been doing now for the last few years when I'm in the Army, somehow didn't figure into the stereotypical idea of how I should behave in my married life and in my business life with my father. And so I just knocked off daily drinking. I just drank only in the evenings. I drank every evening, but I only drank in the evenings. And I drank during the day on weekends, which is all right. You know, you wash the car, cut the lawn, have a few naps and stuff like that, and get through the weekend. And so I didn't understand I was an alcoholic. My parents didn't even drink. And so I had to learn this thing all by myself, which is another part of kind of a sad story in itself, really. And I found myself about a year or so later getting very anxious and nervous and wondering, what's wrong with me? Why am I so shaky? And I'm trying to work on hot wires and stuff like that, and you can't do that when you're shaking. You got to be relaxed. And I've developed a childhood habit of stuttering and stammering when I'm talking, and that's an embarrassment. And so I started having a couple of beers for lunch, which I think is a perfectly all right thing to do, and I was doing that once in a while. And then what happened to me is that I found that drinking beer in the middle of the day made me sleepy, and then I started having a couple of vodka tonics for lunch. Make them a double, if you will. And I'd be doing that, and couldn't tell anybody. I couldn't tell my dad because he had little or no use for people that drank alcohol at all, much less on his pay schedule. And I couldn't tell my wife because she, her mother was a periodic alcoholic, and she certainly wouldn't want to see me drinking during the day. And so it became my little secret. And when she would bitch and complain about my drinking, it just made me more go undercover. And I hid bottles in the house and not behind the garage and different strategic locations where I could have a legal bottle that I bought on a Friday night and drink out of that over the weekend and work bottle A into bottle B and watch the line go up and down. You know, it's a lot of work, I'll tell you that. And it, what happened, I've been Alcoholics Anonymous a long time, and I've heard thousands of Alcoholics Anonymous pitches and people talk in podiums like this, and I envy the kind of like the normal alcoholic, the one that just drank in your face, you know, and just screw you if you don't like the way I'm drinking. I was so timid and afraid and he was going to find out that I was drinking that I hid my booze and whatever. And I'll tell you, if I drink again, I'm going to drink at you like everybody else does. I'm going to do it a little differently this time. But anyway, I was just kind of like this little chicken shit drinker that, you know, just couldn't do it. I was drinking now over a quart a day just to stay even. I wasn't getting drunk particularly. I'm just somehow maintaining this miserable life. And I'm going on this way and the years are passing by. a lot of boring anecdotes about my drinking in my life I wouldn't bother to tell you about because they're just boring and silly. But what happened to me, I developed a terrible phase of my life. I was awfully depressed and just unhappy, and I didn't know what the hell was wrong with me. I mean, there was marital problems, I had financial problems all the time, and the kids are growing up, and I got these responsibilities, and I don't know why I'm so depressed, and that wouldn't have been bad enough, but I'm finding myself sitting in my front seat of my car or my truck, wherever I was doing, beating my fist on the steering wheel 3 o'clock in the afternoon or 3 o'clock in the morning, wondering what's wrong with me. Why am I so unhappy? Where did my life go? Why is it all so wrong? And I could not see how liquor had anything to do with it. It was just something that I did. And I guess you might have said that I was drowning my sorrows. I don't know, but I just couldn't imagine why my life was so awful. Because when you look back on my life, the way I was raised and the advantages that I had, I never wanted for anything. I always had every advantage anybody could have ever wanted. And here I was miserably unhappy in every area of my life, and I don't know what the heck was wrong with me. And I sought the help of a psychiatrist, something we all used to do in the late 50s and early 60s. And I found a doctor I had a pretty good rapport with. And I saw him about two or three times a week in private therapy and group therapy and all the therapies you can dream up. And I saw him about 3 or 4 years in and out of these different therapies. And what happened, unfortunately, is I got sicker and sicker and sicker in this guy's care. I don't know what the problem was. Of course, he would ask me periodically, how much do you drink? And I told him 6 or 8 ounces of alcohol a day, doctor. It seemed like a normal amount for a heavy drinker to drink. I'm more than happy to be a heavy drinker because it is, after all, a sign of manhood or adulthood for me to control and enjoy my drinking with my great obsession. I didn't quite understand when I was controlling it. I wasn't enjoying it. When I was enjoying it, I certainly wasn't controlling it. But I couldn't see any of that in those days. And so all I really wanted to do, and it wasn't much to ask for, is I just wanted to have that nice feeling of being loaded and be able to work and be a husband and a father and function in society. And it was just a constant battle, I suppose. It was just awful. I would lose the mark and get too loaded and pass out and forget things and just be an asshole. And it was just awful. But the fact that I was seeing the psychiatrist gave myself and, of course, my wife and family some sort of semblance of hope that I was getting better. And he would ask me periodically, how much do you drink, Tom? And I told him 6 or 8 ounces of alcohol a day, doctor. It seemed like a normal amount for a heavy drinker to drink. I'm more than happy to be a heavy drinker because it is, after all, a sign of manhood or adulthood for me to control and enjoy my drinking was my great obsession. I didn't quite understand what I was enjoying it. I wasn't enjoying it, but it was just horrible. And what happened is that I would leave the little club in Beverly Hills right around the corner from my psychiatrist's office. I'd had a drink since noon now, and I go in there and I have 3 or 4 double vodkas or scotches, what it is I was drinking, and I get myself well enough to go to this guy's office. And I would be sitting there one particular Thursday afternoon. He looked at me in about 10 minutes and he said, you know, you're drunk. I said, what do you mean I'm drunk? He said, you look drunk, you act drunk, and you smell drunk. I assume you're drunk. I said, well, I had a couple of beers for lunch, which I think is our stock answer. And he says, I think it's a little bit more than that, a little bit more recent. He was going to help me with my drinking problem, albeit my non-existent drinking problem. But I'll go along with the gag, whatever. And he put me on heavy dose of Librium and heavy dose of Stelazine. And if I've been like I thought I was, it's a little mildly neurotic, I'll take the pills they're prescribed and be just fine. And that's exactly what I did. Hell, I took a more than prescribed. I want to get well now, right around a month. And I went to see him a week later, and I said, you know, I feel better this week than I have felt in a long time. I have a certain inner peace that seems to permeate my life, certain tranquility on the job. And he said, that's amazing. Not too soon do people get this immediate result from tranquilizing drugs. I said, well, I guess I'm very fortunate. I said, incidentally, I need another prescription. And he said, you couldn't possibly. I gave you a month's supply. I said, well, I don't know. I must have lost them somewhere. So I had his 2 prescriptions, and I had some from some other doctors. I may be alcoholic, but I'm not stupid. You know, you go to a bunch of different doctors, and you give them a set of symptoms, and if they give you the right drugs, fine. If you don't, you go to another doctor. It's not all that hard to figure. And what happened is that I was popping these pills during the day and drinking behind them. The doctor said, don't drink when you take these medications, but what do they know? And so I was just goofy all the time. Come home some nights, rip that house apart, terrorize that wife and family. Some nights, come home just as peaceful as I am this evening, even more peaceful. Come home 6, 7 o'clock at night, lay down in the living room rug, take a little nap before dinner time. Sometimes I'd miss dinner, but there's other meals. And I'd get up at 11, 12 o'clock at night, go take a leak in the linen closet and go to bed, just leaving it home. My wife is losing her sense of humor over a lot of this kind of stuff, which they'll do. And she filed for divorce again, but she's always filing for divorce, not to worry. I move out of the house, hang around the neighborhood for 2 or 3 days, 2 or 3 weeks, 2 or 3 months, sashay back in again, have some kind of a madcap reconciliation, try to recapture what never was. It's just got to be silly. This time I got myself a one-room place right behind my favorite drinking bar called the Cork and Fork on Westwood Boulevard. And I had a routine where I'd get up in the morning and I'd sit on the edge of my wet bed from perspiration or what have you, and I'd go to the linen closet where I hid the booze for myself, which is kind of interesting, and poured my morning drink and have another one, another one, another one. 8 o'clock in the morning came and I had a half a pint to find in my stomach and I could go off and face the world after I put the murine in the eyes and the breath purifiers on and some cologne and the dark glasses and nobody could look in my eyes and see there was nobody home. And I'd go off and try to last until lunchtime. And some days I would last until lunchtime, but most of the time I couldn't get past 10:30, 11. I'd start to shake and the terrors would come back and I'd say, excuse me, I'll be right back. I've just got to run down for something from the hardware store from something, ma'am. And I'd lay down in the front seat of my car and drink a little hot vodka, never get the motor running where I could last until lunchtime. And I could sit at this bar. I didn't sit at the bar, that's where people like you sit. I sat at a booth and read my Herald Examiner and had my drinks, and after lunch I would go back to work or just go back to my little room and watch General Hospital, whatever seemed appropriate. And that's where my life was in 1965. My wife came to visit me in October of 65. She wanted to see me while I wasn't drinking. It's just about this time, 34 years ago, that she came to visit me in that little room. She told me what kind of a husband I was, what kind of a father I was, what kind of a son I was to my own mother and dad, and what was I going to do about Christmas is coming up, and the kids needed shoes, and they needed this, and the attorney wanted to be paid, and they turned the gas off again, they turned the phone off, all these mundane problems. I don't know what she was telling me about them for, like I'm supposed to do something, but anyway, she mercifully left. In about 20 minutes, I just sort of flipped out. I went temporarily insane, I went goofy, and I was laughing maniacally, and I was crying, and I was crazy. And fortunately for me, the night before, I had just purchased a big, big bottle of 100 Secanol sleeping pills, and I took all of those and a bunch of scotch, and I just checked out. It's the understandable thing to do, because you get to a point with your alcoholism and your drug addiction when you really can't do it anymore. I know we joke in here about this time it'll be different, but I realized that I couldn't do it anymore. Tomorrow was going to be just like yesterday, it's going to be just like last week, it's going to be like tomorrow and next week, and every day was pretty much the same, and nothing new had happened in my life, and I just simply wanted out. And stopping drinking wasn't an answer, because alcohol and drugs, but mainly the alcohol, was the only thing that I could put in my system that made this miserable life somehow workable or tenable. I couldn't work unless I drank. I couldn't talk unless I drank. And you can't tell me that it's the alcohol. I mean, I couldn't drive a car unless I had quite a bit of alcohol because I was shaking and I was too sick. So people joke and say, don't drink and drive. I don't know how the hell you drive if you don't drink. And so I went on this way for a long time. At this time, I realized it was over, and I took my own life this particular morning. And a kid that was working for me part-time thought I was acting a little bizarrely, and he came to my apartment and found me in a coma. And they got the door open, apparently, and they called the ambulance, and they shipped me up to UCLA Medical Center, where they put me full of holes. And I was to stay in this emergency room for about 13 hours, and I came to, apparently. And I looked around in this funny-looking green room, and I thought, Christ, I've even screwed this up. I can't even get out of here. Talk about bad breaks. And they shipped me off by ambulance to another place, the mental institution. And it wasn't all that bad, really. It was a very pleasant place to be. I wasn't left alone there at all. I had an armed guard around me the whole time. But they were afraid to leave me alone, afraid of what I would do to myself. But it wasn't all that bad, really. I could sit in the music room and read books and listen to my jazz music, and nobody could call me, nobody could visit me. But I was in there long enough that I realized I had to be out of there. And I don't know what else I could do, because I just couldn't be in this mental institution. So I got out of there, and the first place I stopped was Jerry's Liquor Store on Olympic Boulevard in West Los Angeles. And of all the things that I talk about in this phase of my talk, it's the most strange and bizarre to me, because wouldn't you think I'd stay sober a couple of months after this experience that I've just been through, or a couple of weeks, or a couple of days, or a couple of hours even. But I can't. I've got to stop at Jerry's and get a quart of each so I can stay loaded for the rest of the weekend, so I can get ready to go to work on Monday, which I did. And I got on the fourth rung of a ladder to change some light bulbs at this person's house in Beverly Hills on Monday morning, and I was too shaky and too sick and too scared, and I told the lady I'll come back another day, and I checked in with another psychiatrist, this one 5 days a week. And if you're wondering how I'm affording a psychiatrist 5 days a week, I'm not. My daddy's taking care of me. I'm only 32 years old. I can't take care of myself or pay my bills or do any of that whole thing. And every day he would ask me, well, what do you say about you today, Tom? My father had no clue about alcoholism or mental illness. He just didn't know what the hell happened to his son, who he loved so much and had cared for, and he just didn't understand any of it at all. And I spent a miserable holiday season, and I just wanted to be by myself. It wasn't that I wanted to be by myself so I could drink by myself and drink the way I wanted to in the classic way. I just wanted to be by myself. I was ashamed of what I'd been through, and I was afraid everybody knew. And I went to Mass on Christmas of 1965, and I asked God to grant me some peace. I didn't want to quit drinking. I just wanted to sleep for more than 2 hours at a time. If you drink the way I drink, getting to sleep is not a major problem, because you drink and you drink, and Lord willing, you pass out. And that's what happened to me every night. But unfortunately, if it affects you the way it affects me, I would wake up in 2 hours, just as wide awake as I am right now. And I would have to pace that room back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, and drink some more and drink some more and walk some more, so I can wear myself out so I can go back to sleep again and sleep for another 2 or 3 hours. My life had been reduced to in 1965. And 2 days later, my prayer was answered, although I didn't see it as such. But I woke up one morning, much like any other day. Nothing new had happened in my life. And I went to my linen closet and poured my morning drink and had another one, another one, another one. And 8 o'clock in the morning came, and I went and put the bottle of vodka back on the top shelf, and I noticed a bottle of Ballantine's scotch had about that much left in it, and I thought, Christ, that's a lot of scotch at 8 o'clock the night before. It was remarkable how much I was drinking it. I was no more or no less than I'm drinking all the way along, but it was kind of like shown to me. And I went to the phone a few hours later, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous of all places, and I sat in the back of the room where you sort of sit when you're new. Don't get too close. Don't pick up any coffee cups or ashtrays. I think you're a member. And I sat back there in my hands, shaking. I had dark glasses on, which was another dead giveaway, and I was sweating profusely, and I was had green slime coming out of my mouth from the breath purifiers I was chewing, so nobody knew I was drinking. And some jerk who was sitting next to me raised my hand as a newcomer, which I think was very nice. I don't know how the hell he knew. And that was the night I walked up to a man who's going to be my sponsor. And I walked up to him and I said, excuse me, sir, you seem to be some sort of a big deal around here. How do you join Alcoholics Anonymous? How to become a member? And he says, you don't drink, kid. I said, yes, I'm planning on cutting down. And he said, no, you really don't have a grasp of my problem. We don't drink here a day at a time. I said, well, it's very easy for you to say. Apparently you're sober sometime. But I can't go a whole day without a drink. I tried it one day in July and it damn near killed me. He thought that was so goddamn funny, and he got some of the guys he sponsored and some of his friends. It's kind of true. You can't exploit and make fun of the new people. What good are they? And so I went back to my psychiatrist, told about his insane AA meetings and these crazy people and these bizarre stories, and he said, not to worry. He reached in his drawer and he pulled a whole big bag of Librium and said, here, take these. They'll get you the rough spots. I thought, great, no problem. I made the mistake, though, of sharing this with my soon-to-be sponsor, and he informed me if I was going to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous as opposed to one that just didn't drink, but if you're going to be sober and be in a position to work this program and find a power greater than yourself and turn your life and your will over to him, you can't do this if you're doing it to some drug. So we don't We don't drink here, obviously, a day at a time. We don't take pills that affect the neck up. We don't smoke marijuana. We don't shoot non-habit-forming heroin. I guess if you came in today, they'd tell you to cut back a little bit, at least, on your cocaine and crack. But to be sober is to be sober. To be sober is hard to get that concept. I mean, I can't buy that. I can't get out of my room in the morning. I have to take a tall glass, put about 4 or 5 fingers of vodka in there, put a little orange juice in there, make kind of a health drink out of it, drink it down, hope it'll stay down, wait for it to work, you know, and then have another little shot because it's not working quite fast enough, and I'm drunk again, just like yesterday, just like the day before. And this man convinced me that I could go a day without a drink and showed me how to do it and told me, physically took me right through it and told me to go down to Santa Monica Beach on a cold January day. And I walked on that beach all day long, sweating and shaking, and every nerve in my body is calling out to give me some booze, give me something. I didn't drink all that morning or that afternoon, and I drank, heard about what to do in those ANA meetings. I drank Carol syrup, drank Cokes and coffee, ate Hershey bars. I probably should have died of a diabetic coma, but somehow I didn't. And I went to the meeting that night, and I realized that I was sitting there, that it was the longest time I've been without a drink since I was a junior in high school. And I thought, how amazing, how miraculous. And I didn't drink the next day nor the next day, and it's hard to believe that in a few months, on January 6th, I'll get a cake with 34 candles on it. You can't, don't do that. Don't interrupt my talk with applause. It takes away from my time. Anyway, but it's hard to believe. I mean, how can that possibly be? Someone that needed to drink and wanted to drink and had to drink the way I drink to make that statement. And I've done little else than just come to this program and get this man as a sponsor and start this journey of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is our step. And I just didn't know what the hell to do. And this man kind of took over for me. And I remember I called him at work once, and something that I tell all the guys that I sponsor now, but I called him at work one time, and I said, I hate to bother you at work, but I'm just crazy, I'm just going goofy. And he said, I'm glad you called me. And I said, well, I hate to bother you at work. And he said, well, I would be very upset if you called me, if you didn't call me and you wanted to. And I tell that to the guys that I sponsor. I mean, it's difficult, and I'm in business for myself, I'm an electrical contractor, and I'm interrupted a lot in my life, at home and at work, by people calling me, but still in all, that's what we do. And it's just difficult, but that's what we do. And this man taught me this. And somehow, through his guidance, I stayed away from the first drink. And many times I needed a drink, I would go, I'd leave the house in a screaming and yelling argument and go to the payphone and call my sponsor before I told him I was going out to get drunk or something like that, or go out to have a drink, but I realized I had a commitment over to Ohio Street, and I had to go down there, and I'll do that later. And the guys that I sponsor now that are having trouble staying sober, I just tell them to just keep delaying it. Just don't drink right now. Drink after the meeting if you have to drink. And then after the meeting is over, go home and go to sleep and drink in the morning. But when you get up in the morning, just drink after breakfast or drink at lunch, or just keep delaying it. An hour at a time, keep delaying it. Before you know it, a whole day's gone by. Before you know it, a couple of days, a couple of weeks, a couple of months, and the years go by. And of course, I can tell you from certain self-knowledge is that it goes by in just a whisker. It just zooms by, as it has with my life. But anyway, I got very active on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to those meetings every night during the first year of my sobriety. After a few months, my wife and I reconciled. I had some naive idea that she was going to go to Al-Anon and get the kids to go to Alateen and Alatot and get the dog to go to Alapet and that other stuff, but that was not going to happen. She couldn't see the need for Al-Anon in her life. It was, after all, my problem. And she continued on with her psychologist, and I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. And maybe to the detriment of my family, I don't know, but it seemed like I needed to completely immerse myself with the fellowship, with the people that are trying to do what I was trying to do. In the room here tonight is an old, dear old friend of mine, Roy Brown, and he and I would go to those coffee shops those early years and talk about our work and our sober life and our families and all that sort of stuff, and we just hung together and just didn't drink. And they're fond, wonderful memories, and I cherish them today. And little by little, time went by and the months went by, and finally I was sober about 8 or 9 months, And I flipped out one Friday night after a wonderful meeting. And they were supposed to feel better after a meeting. Well, I was as crazy and as goofy as I had ever been or been since. And I left the meeting crying and laughing maniacally, and I was just goofy. And I went down to Santa Monica Beach on this full moon night, much like we're having tonight. And I was, maybe that was wrong with me. And went walking around trying to sort it all out, and I couldn't sort it all out. And I ended up at my sponsor's house quite late that night, got him out of bed. He came to the front door and wanted to know why I was parked on his front lawn. I said, I haven't got time to park the car. I got to talk to you now. Anyway, I went and parked the car in the street with the rest of the cars. And we came in and talked about what was bothering me. And the reason I went to see him, and I really was able to verbalize this just in the last couple of years, but the reason I went to see him was that I was looking for a magic sentence that night. I wanted to go to my sponsor's house and have him give me a magic sentence and have everything all right. And I was going to leave there wonderful, and he couldn't do it that night. He didn't have any magic sentences. He was fresh out. And he told me to go home and start a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself, which is a fourth step. And I didn't see how it applied to me. I had spent so much of my life at the Catholic religion of examination of conscience and confession. If that's not a fourth and fifth step, what is? Years that I'd spent in psychiatrist offices talking about what I used to be like, what happened, I'm like now, and talking about all that stuff. And I think too much thinking about myself and too much recrimination was my problem. And he cursed me and embarrassed me, and against my better judgment, I had to go home and start this fourth step. But I was able to put in that fourth step things I was never able to tell a Catholic priest in confession because they were too tacky, too embarrassing, too sinful, if you will, things that I couldn't tell a psychiatrist. You can't tell them that kind of stuff. They'll think you're crazy. So you got to be very guarded what you tell people in that venue. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. And I was able to do this. And took a fifth step with this man. And when it was over with, if nothing else, I felt more like a bona fide member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because when I was sitting at the meeting, I realized when they were reading in chapter 5 that these are the steps we took. I thought, yeah, me too. I've done these steps too. And I did my sixth and seventh step on my knees, as he told me to do, and started on this journey, as I talked about before. I was giving a talk on the sixth and seventh step about a month ago. And it dawned on me, I think really quite frankly, and it's been so many years now, but I think when I finished that sixth and seventh step and I made my amends, at least I wrote the list of people I had harmed and made the amends that I could have, I really thought that I was pretty much perfect. I had done it all and I had released it all and I had done this and I thought it was pretty wonderful. Unfortunately, as I said at the meeting that night, life sets in after a while and some stuff kind of creeps back in again. And I lost all that sainthood. I don't know, little things came back, sort of devious business practices and practices in my home life and stuff like that. And I found out my favorite meeting of all time is my Monday night meeting in Laguna Niguel, where I live in Orange County. It's a step study meeting, and I love being in that meeting because it keeps me in the middle of the program. It keeps me in the middle of the steps. I have a lot to share there because I've been sober a long time, and I may not know very much, but I do know how to stay sober, and I do know how to work the steps. But basically, the real reason that I'm in that meeting every Monday night is that it keeps me in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And where I was able to get away with some stuff maybe 4, 5, 6, 7 years ago, the road does, in fact, get much narrower, and you have to kind of hone things down a little bit. And I think the basic deal in these inventories and in this journey of the steps is that you uncover, discover, and discard, which Chuck used to talk about. And that's what I think we do here in Alcoholics Anonymous with these steps. And we keep ourselves comfortable enough so we don't ever have to put that crap back in our systems anymore. And I think that's basically what we do here. And so that's why I like this particular step study meeting that I go to, that keeps me doing this deal, which has given me such a wonderful life. I looked around after a few years and saw these towhead little children grow up, and they were getting out of high school. And they looked at them, and they were stoned out of their minds. loaded to the gills, selling drugs out the back door. You couldn't walk in the living room without getting contact high, and it was just driving me crazy. And it was my wife at the time was going along with what the kids were doing, and it was just like my youngest son said, our family gave a whole new meaning to the dysfunctional. But what happened is that my wife filed for divorce in 1974, and that's when I moved from West Los Angeles down to Dana Point, where I live near now. And as I was driving down the freeway, I was thinking, am I doing my will or his will? You know, when you're around here a while, you don't want to screw this thing up. You want to do it correctly. And so I said a prayer that my sponsor gave me, and I'll share it with you. It goes like this. God, I have no idea where I'm going. I do not see the road ahead of me, and I cannot know for certain where it'll end, nor do I really know myself. And the fact that I think I'm following your will does not mean that I'm actually doing so. But I believe this. I believe the desire to please you does, in fact, please you. And I hope I have that desire in everything I do, and I hope I never do anything apart from that desire. And I know if I do this, you will lead me by the right road, though I may know nothing about the time, though I may seem to be lost. In the very shadow of death, I'll not be afraid, because I know you will never leave me to face my troubles all alone. And with this, I continued on down the freeway, and of course, immediately I told him the kind of apartment I wanted. I want the business to be run. Of course, you don't do this stuff. You just practice it. And you know, my business went along pretty well. The early 70s were very difficult in the building business in those days, but somehow I survived it. I figured I could starve to death in a nicer area of the country than in Los Angeles. And I built up a pretty good business in South Orange County. I started to date again, and I met this girl, and we had dated for a while, and then we broke up, and then we started to go back together again. And when she called me from South Coast Hospital in 1977, in January, that she'd had a radical mastectomy, I went to visit her, and I said, where are you going to move to? And she said, well, I don't think I want to go here or there or back to there or whatever. And I said, well, come home with me, and I'll take care of you until you feel better, until you get back on your feet. And she did that, and of course, the relationship intensified, and we were ultimately married, and we had a good relationship and a pretty good marriage in those in the years that we were together. It was difficult being involved with somebody that was suffering with cancer. I mean, they were like 7 surgeries and constant chemotherapy and an unbelievable amount of radiation and a lot of false hopes, and you think it's in remission, and then it pops out over here in some bone scan. If any of you have been with anybody that suffered and died with cancer, you know what I'm talking about. And if you don't know, you really don't want to know. But anyway, we got through all that kind of stuff. I think the only real problem in that marriage was our kids, especially my two. She didn't appreciate having a couple of drug addict, alcoholic children popping in and out, and I didn't mind. I didn't care much for her 3 daughters and a son who were not much better condition than my kids were in. And they all came to visit us with terrible regularity. It was just crazy watching them stoned out of their minds coming in and out of our house. It was just a joy to watch. They called me from General Hospital and about 22 years ago now, I guess, that my youngest son had fallen out of a second-story window, stoned on angel dust and some cheap wine, and I went to visit him up at General Hospital. I said, Jim, this is much to shoot for. Why don't you get out of this scuzzy city and come on down to Dana Point, and I'll put you to work for me, and you can get yourself an apartment. Well, he was having too good a time, so he stayed up there for a while longer after he got out of the hospital. And he came down some time later, and he went to work for me, and he realized that I would not tolerate having anybody work for me who was loaded all the time. And so he kept rather sober while he was in my view. He got picked up one Saturday night for drunk walking, and when he got out of jail, he realized he had to quit drinking, and did all on his own with no program, no nothing. He just simply cut it right out. He did it all on Quaaludes and marijuana, which is another whole program. And I didn't realize I was having lunch one day with my son Jim, and Clint Hodges was a friend of mine in Tustin, and we just suggested that Jim come to our Wednesday night meeting, which is my home group in Laguna Beach, the speaker meeting on Wednesday night, strictly for the entertainment value, because our best speaker was speaking that night, Norm Alpe, and I thought he would enjoy it. He came to the meeting anyway, and he enjoyed it and loved it, and he stood up the following week as a newcomer. And it's hard to believe, but He got a cake with 20 candles on it last May. Don't interrupt my talk. May. And I'm very proud of him, how he stayed sober and all this whole thing. It's been really, really neat. My oldest son will have 17 years the first day of December. So I'm very blessed. I have all these sober kids, and it's just a neat deal. I watched my wife suffer from this disease of cancer, and she finally died the day after Christmas of 1985. And it was just, I was devastated when this was over with, because I had turned my life, my will over his care. I'd done a third step on the whole thing, and she died anyway. I mean, that's something wrong there somewhere. And it taught me something, which I tell the guys I sponsor, really, I guess it's kind of true. It's a little easier for me to do a third step in my experience, because I see the futility of trying to plot and plan what God's supposed to do. And you really, if the steps mean what they mean, and they really are true, you turn your life in the will of the care of God, and let the chips fall where they may, and just get up every morning and do what you're supposed to do when you're supposed to do it. I tell this to the guys I sponsor, and I tell it to myself, too, to do what you're supposed to do when you're supposed to do it. And if you don't know what you're supposed to do, that's why we have sponsors, to check things out with and go through this thing together. You don't have to go through this thing alone. You go through it with your friends, and especially with your sponsor, and you just... You're never alone. Those newcomers that are out there, you'll never have to do anything alone again. And so I went through all this whole deal. And I took 1986 off. Of course, I did my AA stuff, which I, of course, have always done. But I went to work, and I went to a lot of movies, and I read a lot of books, and I took a few long weekends, and somehow got through 1986. It was a terrible year. I had no joy that whole year, but somehow I got through it. I just suited up and showed up and went to work or went to my AA stuff and whatever and got through it all. And after 1986 was over, 1987, I started to look around and started to date again. And I saw this beautiful blonde lady get her fifth cake in 1987. And I thought, now there is a classy looking, beautiful woman. And so I called her sponsor to see if it was all right if we went out on a date. And she thought it'd be a good idea. And so, I invited Gloria to go out to dinner one night, and we've been together ever since, and we'll be married 12 years this coming March, and we have a wonderful, happy marriage and a lovely home in Laguna Niguel, and I love her very, very much, and you can see what a lovely lady she is, and it's just been a neat deal. We have an AA house. Our only annoyance is every time we sit down for dinner, Gloria knows the moment we sit down, it's just like it's on cue, the phone starts to ring. But anyway, we have a good life. When my youngest son came and told me that he was a homosexual, it just destroyed me. I thought, how can this be? I mean, something I did, obviously, or didn't do, or should have done, or who knows? And we worked through all of that out and got through it all. He and his friend moved to the island of Maui about 12 years ago, and they set up shop over there. They, among other things, they fitness and sold toe rings, which I guess is every father's dream, and to have that happen. I asked him about six, seven years ago, I said, Jim, it doesn't look like I'm ever going to become a grandfather. He said, well, we're trying. So, you know, you just try to figure that kind of stuff if you can. My youngest boy, my oldest boy made me a grandfather about a little over 4.5 years ago, and that's a joy of my life. I had to go up to Los Angeles to talk in the San Fernando Valley Wednesday night, and so I took my grandson to the shopping mall, and we bought some stuff that he liked, and he and I had dinner together, and we had a wonderful time. He's such a joy to be with. And then I took him back to his mother, who was worried sick because he was her son was out with his crazy grandfather. And went off to the meeting and gave his jury talk Wednesday night. But we have a good life. Gloria had a son who, well, by the time we were dating and starting to go together, she was trying to put her best foot forward and try to act like everything's all together. And here she had a son who the drug dealers are after in Westwood, in West Los Angeles, and they owed him about $2,000. And he didn't have the money, and he came to his mother, and he tried to con the money out of her, and she's had the money, but checked with some of her AA friends and said, not a good idea, because she had had been sober now about 5 years, and she had gotten her life back together again. She had lost these two kids through her drinking, and it was just a hideous story, and she'd little by little had worked her way back to some respectability and the fact of being a mother again. And then her son comes to her for help and didn't know what to do. And so she said, no, I don't think it'd be a good idea. I can get you some help for your sobriety if that's what you wanted. And he just left town and went to Miami Beach, Florida, and stayed down there about a year. And it was just chaos. She didn't know whether he was alive or dead. And he called about a year later and said he had gotten to Gainesville, Florida, and he'd gotten sober. And he stayed sober for almost 10 years. He came back to Orange County when he was sober about a year or more, and got graduated from UCLA, got married, had some children, moved up to Santa Maria, which is a little community of north of Santa Barbara in California, started business up there and had these two little children. And it takes a lot of time to start a business and raise a family and have a new home, and something had to give. I mean, you know, where he was going to 4 or 5 meetings a week, he was now going to 2, and then 1, and then none. And then he got depressed, surprise, surprise, and he saw this psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist put him on, I guess, his Prozac stuff, and that made him feel okay. And so the doctor decided he could lose some weight, so he gave him some diet medication, and he really liked that. Before you know it, he was taking these drugs, drinking again, and taking the crack and the cocaine and the drug and the whole routine again. And the story's different now. When he was getting sober before, he was footloose and fancy-free and single. And now he is married and has a home and a business and 2 little babies. And the story's a little bit different. Well, thank God, I think next weekend, he's going to get 2 years on the program. And I'm very pleased for him, and I hope he stays. But you know, I bet there's nobody in this room who's alcoholic who doesn't really know and believe that they're going to be sober the rest of their lives. And it just isn't true. How precious this thing is. I mean, we all think we're going to be sober, but it takes a lot of work, and it takes a lot of going to meetings, a lot of helping out, a lot of commitments, a lot of working with others, and the steps, and all that sort of stuff to keep us in these rooms. And that's what we want to do, so we can have this this good life. I sponsor a lot of guys on the program, which is a great thing to me, and I find them coming in and out of all kinds of problems, and it's good for me to be involved with other people's lives. I dearly love the guys I sponsor. And one thing I could tell anybody that's got some sobriety now is to work with other people and find out through their lives what you used to be like and how you can change your life. I've enjoyed this evening very, very much. I'd like to thank Stan for all his hospitality and help and everybody else. And thank you very much.